Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space
this
travel.
This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. Whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. Yeah, we might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. There's so much in the news this week, I don't even know where to start, but there are a lot of updates we're going to give tonight. The solar wind today is a blistering 588 kilometers per second. And there are five sunspot clusters active on the sun. As predicted, a coronal mass ejection hit Earth's magnetic field this morning. The impact lifted the solar wind speed from, a measly 300 kilometers per second to almost 700 kilometers per second. It's still close to 600 and sparked a moderately strong geomagnetic storm. Northern lights spilled across the Canadian border into the United States as far south as Colorado. They get a solar cycle 24 yet, you know, we're just now entering the 2013 upswing, so we'll see what happens there. Our phone lines will be open all night tonight, toll free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. I'll give that number out often tonight. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537. Also, don't forget, if you are out and about, there are two ways to reach us by cell phone just to listen. One is to use the Android app, which is at X Squared Radio's website, x2-radio.com. Just click on the Android app icon on the front page. Or you can dial 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and the passcode 769-608 pound. And you can listen on your cell phone. Now, you won't be able to talk with us unless you hang up and call, but you'll be able to listen all night. Also, I realize that a lot of you, including myself, went out and did your taxes this week. Hopefully, you're getting something back. You might have discovered a couple of things as you were going over those taxes. One was the Patriot Act information that was accompanying your tax return information. And the other was the Obamacare fines that will be handed out next year if you don't buy health insurance. My fine will be somewhere close to $300 next year, which I will happily pay because I take care of my own health care without insurance. The other thing that you might notice is that you are going to get a refund, and with that refund, I would like to suggest that you do something smart with it. Yes, it's nice to get out of debt. No question about it. I wouldn't go out and buy something with it unless it was silver, but you might get yourself out of debt. If you're already out of debt or very close to it, you might consider this a very wise investment indeed. One of our best affiliates, if not the best affiliate, and that is the Food Investor. The banner is right there at x2-radio.com on the right-hand side, right at the very top, the Food Investor. Why do I suggest that? Because my friends Scott and Danny out there in Utah have built a company on great-tasting, no preservatives added, highly nutritious, 30-year packaging food storage. I have some. Many of our listeners have done it since the last tax season. And that's what I suggest. And I suggested it during the Christmas season as well. If you really wanted to give your loved ones something, give them the security that if there were a need to move in a disaster situation, tornado, flood, fire, hurricane, God forbid some kind of national emergency or regional emergency, they could grab that backpack by the front door and head out with plenty of food to take care of themselves and their loved ones. Please click on the banner at x2-radio.com, The Food Investor. Make a wise investment with that refund check this year. All right, let's get started. One of the interesting things I read in the news, this just came out, was that there has been a second drone spotted over New York. Now, you know, New Yorkers, you would think, would be particularly sensitive to strange things in their airspace, given the not-too-distant history. But not too many people are excited about this. But for the second time within a week, police are investigating reports of an unmanned drone spotted flying over New York within 3 miles of LaGuardia Airport. Now, that's not permitted. According to journalist Christopher Robbins, police scanner audio revealed that the NYPD was called to look into an unusual incident concerning reports of a drone flying near exit 23 of the Long Island Expressway, the LIE. According to Robbins, the NYPD later reported a negative result after investigating the incident, although it is unclear whether this means they couldn't identify the drone or had discounted the report altogether. Last Monday, the crew of Al Italia Flight 608 reported a drone just 200 feet away from their aircraft as it approached John F. Kennedy Airport. The drone was initially reported as having four engines, but the FBI later described the object as having four propellers and being only 3 feet wide. The incident, which occurred at 1,750 feet and roughly 3 miles from runway 31R, prompted the FBI to ask the public for information on identifying the owner of the drone. No calls, no evidence was collected. By law, remote-controlled planes and drones can only fly to a maximum of 400 feet, and operators must notify air traffic control if they're going to fly within 3 miles of an airport. Well, I can tell you from drone training and drone operations that once you get above 400 feet, they're very difficult to control because the radio controller doesn't reach out that far. I've been to lots of air races with remote-controlled airplanes, and usually you sit in an elevated chair. You have like a 3 or 4 foot antenna, lots of batteries so that you can reach out there to the craft and be able to fly it because in scale, these planes fly about 500 miles an hour in scale. Now, I will tell you that when they hit the ground, they splatter. They splatter. So you really have to be a good pilot and know how to fly. If you're going to fly a model airplane, that's one thing. If you're going to fly a drone, that's quite something else. That's a lot more sophisticated. For a remote-controlled airplane to be flying at 1,750 feet is almost impossible. It would have to be a frequency and a power rating and a receiver rating much, much higher and more sophisticated than a regular remote-controlled plane. Most remote-controlled planes do not fly at that altitude. For one thing, they're almost impossible to see from the ground. You don't really get any enjoyment out of flying a remote control plane that high because it doesn't appear to be moving in the air. You know, they only fly maybe 60 or 80 miles an hour, real world speed. And at that altitude, it's just poking along, you know, like a sparrow up that high. But a drone is quite something else. A drone has its own eyes. A drone has a GPS locator, usually. A drone has a much more sophisticated designated radio frequency to take complex messages and to feed information that it's picking up from whatever kind of surveillance equipment it has on board back to some kind of monitoring device, be it a computer or a recorder or some other digital device. Get it? So the question is, if there are drones flying in this kind of congested Class A airspace, Class A means you are near a airport with a tower and scheduled service. Class A airspace, you are not supposed to be up there without a transponder, and you're not supposed to be up there without direct communication with the tower. So the tower can put you in a pattern, especially if you're below 10,000 feet. At 1,750 feet, you are above the 1,500-foot low ceiling. Unless you're on approach, you better stay above 1,500 feet or somebody's going to be visiting you up there. Which tells me that law enforcement really doesn't know what or who, what was flying or who was flying it, who was operating it. And that's a little worrisome because when you think about the weaponry or the surveillance equipment or just the fact that it's in the pattern and could disrupt orderly flow of aircraft into and out of these airports, it takes mischief to a new level. Let's put it that way. Okay? In May of last year, a military or police drone flying in controlled airspace over Denver almost caused a mid-air collision with a Cessna jet. And that was a military or a police drone. And last year, Congress passed legislation paving the way for what the FAA predicts will be around 30,000 operating in U.S. skies by 2020. Now, obviously, that's going to have to be much more orderly. Obviously, that's going to be IFR, which means I Fly Roads, not instrument flight rating. It means they're going to be flying freeways, and they're going to be looking for speeders because nobody flies drones for a local sheriff's department unless it's going to make money, and lots of it. Okay? Within months, the drone industry announced a campaign to bombard the American public with positive images and messages about drones in an effort to reverse the growing perception of the aircraft as a threat to privacy and safety, mostly a threat to privacy. You know, we have a relationship with our automobile. Don't we not? I mean, we do. We sit in it. We have a relationship with it. We steer it. We drive it the way we want to drive it. Yes, sometimes we get sighted, but that's all part of the cost of ownership. But this kind of monitoring interferes with that personal relationship with the automobile. As we reported in December, thousands of pages of Federal Aviation Administration documents newly released under the Freedom of Information Act have revealed that the military, as well as law enforcement agencies, are already extensively flying surveillance drones in non-restricted skies throughout the country. It's already happening. We call it the drone wars, and we usually give drone war updates here at least once a month. FAA documents obtained by the Center for Investigative Reporting last August revealed that the FAA gave the green light for surveillance drones to be used in U.S. skies, despite the fact that during the FAA's own tests, the drones crashed numerous times, even in areas of airspace where no other aircraft were flying. Critics have warned that the FAA has not acted to establish any safeguards whatsoever and that Congress is not holding the agency to account. I can tell you now that if these drones are not electric, they're powered by kerosene or gasoline, then they are, in a sense, a flying incendiary. Because if they crash in a neighborhood, and some of these drones have a 6 foot, 8 foot wingspan, they crash at a couple hundred miles an hour, they can catch a house on fire, land in a school or a hospital, or, God forbid, a fuel storage depot, and we really have a big problem on our hands. Given the fact that they're already flying roads, that where vehicles are sometimes 10 and 12 lanes wide, traveling at 70, 80 miles an hour, a drone losing control in a situation like that could cause a absolutely fatal pileup. Not to mention the fact that it's distracting to drivers who might look up and see a drone following them or following the car in front of them, or God forbid, you know, having a head-on with them. It's just not the kind of thing that you want to see on American highways. Bottom line is, folks, we are not the enemy. And the question remains, especially with respect to this one that was flying near LaGuardia this week, whose drone is that? I mean, whose is it? Is it a private citizen? Is it another mischief maker? Let's call him someone with not public safety in mind that's flying it near the airport, just kind of testing the waters, seeing if they can fly in under the radar, seeing if they can cause havoc or maybe cause some confusion in the flight pattern. Well, Digital Watchdog, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, published several thousand papers of new drone license records on Wednesday of this week, confirming innumerable theorists' fears that drones regularly fly in national airspace all around the country. I'm telling you, it's already happening. These are not rumors. These are not speculations. These are actual permits, the drone license records that the Electronic Frontier Foundation got on Wednesday of this week, just 3 days ago. The records, which were obtained by way of a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Federal Aviation Administration, come from state and local law enforcement agencies, universities, and, for the first time, three branches of the U.S. military. That's right, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Now, that means that federal troops, federal armed forces, are flying drones inside the United States. Are they running contracts for law enforcement? Maybe, but maybe they're doing military operations. Maybe they're doing military monitoring of you. According to the records, the Air Force has been testing out a variety of drones, from the smaller hand-launched Raven, Puma, and Wasp drones, to the larger Predator and Reaper models, largely responsible for countless civilian and foreign military deaths. By the way, a Reaper drone can cost $500,000. That's right. With the right instrumentation and weaponry, a Reaper and Predator drone can run several $100,000 apiece. And now that the new Hellfire missile Mini has been shrunk down to only 3 feet long, they can carry substantial firepower. Breaking down the shocking capabilities of the various machines, a group called Deep Links writes that the technologies take surveillance to a whole new level. Now, according to a recent Gizmodo article, the Puma all-environment drone can land anywhere. That's right, either in tight city streets or onto a water surface like a lake or a pond, if the mission dictates. Even after a near vertical steep stall final approach, another drone, In Situ's Scan Eagle, which the Air Force has flown near Virginia Beach, sports an internally stabilized camera turret that allows for the tracking of a target of interest for extended periods of time, even when the target is moving and the aircraft nose is seldom pointed at the target. In other words, you don't have to actually follow the target with the plane. You can do large, lazy circles with the plane while the camera turret stays locked on the target. It's sort of like a sighting mechanism observation mechanism for an F-117 stealth. You remember those films, don't you, with the crosshairs aimed at the ventilator shaft, and you see the missile go right down the middle of the elevator shaft, even though that plane's flying at pretty close to 600 miles an hour, the crosshairs stay locked right on the ventilator shaft. That's what I'm talking about. Boeing's A-160 Hummingbird, which the Air Force has flown near Victorville, California, is capable of staying in the air for 16 to 24 hours at a time and carries a gigapixel camera. Do you have one of those? I have a megapixel camera. But a gigapixel camera? That's 1,000 million bits. And a Forrester foliage penetration radar system, which means it can see right through leaves, right through fog, right through smoke, and in the dark. Designed by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. Perhaps the scariest, though, is the technology carried by a Reaper drone that the Air Force is flying near Lincoln, Nevada, in areas of California and in Utah. Those of you out there listening to X Squared Radio in Utah, pay close attention. This drone uses Gorgon Stare technology, which Wikipedia defines as a spherical array of 9 cameras attached to an aerial drone capable of capturing motion imagery of an entire city. This imagery can then be analyzed by humans or an artificial intelligence, such as the Mind's Eye project being developed by DARPA. So you get the idea. We are now one nation under surveillance. Any thoughts about this? I'd be happy to hear them. 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. And North America is not unique. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you want to talk about this, we can talk about it. 530-413-9537. It's springtime here in North Carolina. Lots of wonderful things blooming. And my sinuses are letting me know that. So just in case you hear a sniffle or two, no, I don't have a cold. Ah, but that fruit juice is so good. All right, for the second time in a very short period of time, and for the fourth time in about a year and a half, UFOs have been reported over Ocala, Florida. Eyewitnesses said the aircraft looked like a bunch of helicopters flying in formation with a large plane. The mystery aircraft were most recently spotted Monday, that's just almost a week ago, between 2 a.m. to 3 a.m., witnesses said. However, a Navy spokesman said the military does not conduct operations at the bombing range in the Ocala National Forest at that time of morning, and that is all we're going to say about that. Got any ideas out there? What is flying over Ocala, Florida? Listeners down there, pay close attention. If you have any photos, recordings, or thoughts about this, please send them in. My email address is bagnew@x2-radio.com. Now, from time to time, we get excited about all the algorithms it takes to play with the economy. And we have talked about naked short trading here several times, enough where you should be familiar with what that is. One of the key components of naked short trading of stocks, the main one, of course, is to sell shares that don't exist, fake shares, they're called phantom shares, into the market at a substantial discount for what the shares are normally selling for. This depresses the price, which is exactly what a short trader wants to have happen. Not only does he get to pocket the money, but he also makes money because you just drove the price of the stock down. Well, the other key component is the market maker. Now, the market maker is not only the guy that's betting, but he's the guy that releases the press. He's the guy that leaks the bad stories to the press to make the stock change its price. And it's usually the market maker that gets away scot-free. Sometimes they make money directly, and sometimes they don't. In this case, the founder of Intrade received $2.6 million in insufficiently documented payments. Okay, that is a classy way of saying laundered cash. Okay, this is cash that came from illegitimate sources. Okay, it means it's unearned. It means somebody made this cash the wrong way and it was insufficiently documented. Okay, anyway, these payments came from the popular prediction markets company, Market Makers, in 2010 and 2011. An audit revealed weeks before trading on the site was halted. Now, that's what I'm talking about, people. Catch these market makers, and you catch these naked short traders, and you stop them from trading. Auditors for the Dublin-based company. Now, keep in mind, this would never happen in the United States. Now, I'm not talking about the naked short trading. That goes on for sure. But the halting of the trading would never happen in the U.S. In this administration, we have not seen one, not one, prosecution of Wall Street. Every single loss, every single ripoff of depositors, every single naked shorting, even though it's illegal, has gone on with impunity inside the United States. But auditors for the Dublin-based company, an online hub where people can bet on everything from presidential elections to papal conclaves, highlighted concerns about significant financial irregularities and the payments made to John Delaney, according to financial records Intrade recently filed with Ireland's Companies Registration Office. Mr. Delaney, who launched Intrade's parent company in 1999, died on Mount Everest in May of 2011. He sure likes climbing mountains of one kind or another. The documents also revealed that the company's shareholders in 2011 included hedge fund managers Paul Tudor Jones and Stanley Druckenmiller, and a trust connected to Christopher Haymeyer, the current chairman of the National Futures Association, a U.S. regulatory body. None of the shareholders could be reached for comment on Monday. Imagine that. The revelations came a day after Intrade suspended all trading activity and froze its customer accounts. The company said in a notice on its site on Sunday that received discovered circumstances on which it did not elaborate would be subject to an investigation and could uncover potential financial irregularities. In other words, somebody made a heck of a lot of money by making exactly the right bets at exactly the right time. The discovery raises questions about the oversight of unregulated prediction markets, market makers, and comes 3 months after the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission sued to stop the company from offering prediction contracts to Americans, who were the most active users of the site. Intrade did not refer to the CFTC case in its notice to customers on Sunday. An Intrade official and Caulfield Dunn, the Dublin-based accountancy that performed the audit, did not immediately respond to requests for comment, and they still have not. The financial accounts show payments made to Mr. Delaney worth $1.4 million in 2011 and $1.2 million in 2010. Brian Dunn, auditor at Caulfield Dunn, said in a written opinion on Friday the 4th that proper books of account were not kept by Intrade for the year ended December 2011. He noted the current directors of the company were only appointed in November of 2012 and were not in a position to comment on the maintenance of the books prior to their appointment. The directors have also noted that they were aware of issues identified during the course of the audit with regard to significant financial irregularities in the internal accounts pertaining to the previous year. In other words, didn't happen on my watch, guys. I'm not responsible. He added there was insufficient documentation regarding payments made into bank accounts in the name of the deceased former director and other third parties. Dun, dun, dun. Well, there you go. Now you know at least what they're doing in Ireland to stop this kind of market making and naked short trading. The number of visitors to the InTrade site, of course, has plummeted because people are watching. Bettors on InTrade entered contracts that paid $10 for correctly guessing the outcome of events from elections to the Academy Awards. Academics and journalists toasted the site as a novel way to divine the wisdom of crowds. After the suit was filed in November of 2012, InTrade had said it hoped to reopen inside the U.S. Well, newsflash, the case is still pending in federal court in Washington. It's been almost 2 years. Last year, the CFTC prohibited the Chicago-based North American Derivatives Exchange from introducing what would have been the first regulated U.S. political event contracts, saying they involve gaming and are contrary to the public interest. Sounds like gambling to me, but then again, what's the difference between that and the Dow? As of early Sunday, wagers on the identity of the successor to recently resigned Pope Benedict were among InTrade's most popular markets. Kind of interesting. A total of 52,166 unique trades had occurred since January 1st already. Well, let me just shift gears a little bit, and we'll talk about what appears to be one of the more scary insect stories that we've had on this program. You know, if you ever go to Alaska, or for that matter, North Dakota, in the wintertime, the last thing in the world you have to worry about is, well, flies or mosquitoes. But in the summertime, if there is a summertime in North Dakota and Alaska, it's brief, it's hot, and life has to make up for lost time. So the flies and the ladybugs and the mosquitoes are particularly nasty. In Florida now, they're called gallon pippers. As if deadly sinkholes and Burmese pythons weren't enough, now Florida may find itself contending with another summer of giant mosquitoes that pack a ferocious bite, Live Science reports. Now, I don't like the little mosquitoes, do you? I mean, if they're buzzing around my eyes or my ears, I'm swatting. If they're landing on my legs and arms, I'm going for the off, you know? I don't like the idea of insect going from one person over there, sucking a drop of blood, landing on me, putting that little needle in my arm, and grabbing another drop just to round it out. Do you? Well, these aren't little. Dubbed gallon pippers, they're the size of a quarter-sized mosquitoes, hatch after a flood or rainstorm, and saw a bumper crop after Tropical Storm Debbie struck Florida last summer. Now another rainy season could produce even more. A gallon pipper is a whopping 20 times the size of a typical mosquito. And it's mean, and it goes after people, and it bites, and it hurts, says Anthony Pelez of Tampa's Museum of Science and Industry. A gallon pipper bite feels like you're being stabbed. Well, what's more, they may be resistant to bug repellent. Oh, yeah. DEET-containing repellent doesn't even work. And They like to strike fish, wild animals, and pets. So be wary if you have a short-haired pet and you let it out into the yard. By the way, a factoid on these things, entomologists don't always recognize the term gallon pipper, which arose in southern folk culture. But the insect's first mention dates back all the way to 1897, when a writer called it the shyest, slyest, meanest, and most venomous of them all. Sorry about that, folks. I will not be visiting Florida after a big rainstorm. And I would recommend staying indoors. Now I know why Florida residents who have outdoor swimming pools also have outdoor screen cages over their pools, so they can go swim in the darn things in the evening. Because if you're swimming in one of these and you come up for air and a gallon pipper nails you in the back of the neck while you're floating around, or happens to land on your stomach while you're floating on your back, or catching some rays on that float in the middle of your pool, that is not going to be a happy day. Can you imagine the welt these things leave when they bite you? Ah, that's just insane. Just to let you know, I think a good old-fashioned fly swatter will take care of them. Our phone number tonight, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. If you've got a news story you want to talk about, something in the economics or in drone wars, and I do have a Wars R Us update that's going to, well, it's going to enlighten you. We also, because this is a very strange year for banking, I call it a juxtaposition. If we can make it through this year and we can actually see some value go back into American manufacturing, we might actually pull out of this. But there are two things stopping it. Number one is that there is no access to capital for American manufacturing in America. You have to go outside the country to get capital to bring it back into the country. It's difficult to do. Why? Well, quite simply, America's largest investors are yanking their money out of the banks as fast as they can and shipping it out of the country. U.S.-based non-financial companies are parking record amounts of cash abroad, thanks largely to a tax code that encourages them to indefinitely keep profits from their foreign subsidiaries outside of the country. Some of the largest companies in the U.S. greatly boosted their tax avoiding cash stockpiles abroad last year, according to recent surveys of company filings from the Securities and Exchange Commission. Keep in mind, these are only the publicly traded companies, okay? Privately held companies or LLCs do not have to report their cash stockpiles to anyone. The difference? Well, General Motors is publicly traded. LLC. For example, the Jedi Master of avoiding U.S. taxation, General Electric, increased its tax-free cash accumulation to a whopping $108 billion, up from an estimated $94 billion in 2010. Microsoft Corporation increased its stockpile to $61 billion, up 36% from 2011 and up from $30 billion in 2010. That's about a 100% increase. Apple raised its ante to $40 billion, up 73% from 2011. Sure sounds like this administration is encouraging these companies to invest in America. 60, in fact, of the country's largest non-financial corporations kept $166 billion in cash outside of the U.S. last year. Financial corporations, these are just the non-financial. Financial corporations It's going to blow your mind. These companies shielded more than 40% of their profits from taxes, according to a report in Monday's Wall Street Journal. And that's from total overseas earnings, get this, $1.3 trillion, up 15% from 2011. Yeah, that's the kind of reinvestment in America we like to see. A separate analysis, pardon me while I pull my tongue out of my cheek here. A separate analysis of 83 of the largest non-financial corporations found that companies increased that by $183 billion, their foreign-based cash accumulations, representing a 14.4% rise from 2011. That's just 2 years, according to Bloomberg. The corporate system is broken, no question about it. And it's broken primarily because of international tax laws. Edward Kleinbard, a tax professional at the University of Southern California, told this to Bloomberg. The journal survey said the propensity to keep profits outside of the U.S. was most prevalent among tech and healthcare companies. I wonder why. 26 of them on the list of 60 kept $160 billion abroad last year. That's the kind of money we need to see inside this country working. In the first quarter of 2012, the Federal Reserve estimated in its flow of funds report that U.S. non-financial companies held $1.7 trillion in liquid assets. That would be cash. In the first quarter of last year. But that figure only accounts for U.S.-based assets. Only. According to the IRS figures, the total amount of liquid assets in the first half of last year was much higher, $5.1 trillion. That means for every dollar a U.S. non-financial company held outside the U.S., it held $3 of it abroad. $3 out of $5. Never made it back to the U.S. According to Pulitzer Prize-winning financial journalist and author David K. Johnston, the reasons for hoarding cash abroad are threefold. I want you to pay close attention to this. Profits held overseas aren't taxed if they're owned by offshore subsidiaries. Companies have had no incentive to invest these proceeds due to the lackluster growth in jobs and wages. Oh, and I might add, very, very high capital gains taxes if they do invest. And wages that suppress demand for goods and services, which means people aren't earning enough money to buy the darn products they're making. And mountains of cash held in offshore accounts provide a nice cushion if the economy gets worse. And there's a fourth, which I would like to add to the Pulitzer Prize-winning financial journalist's paper. And that is that they trade the currency in the markets. That is to say, they buy yen and yuan and rubles and rupees, and they trade the currencies in all these little micro trades every single day, and they make an additional 10-12% per month. Yeah, per month. On an annual basis, it's between 100 and 150% interest. That's what you're competing with. And when asked why they're moving so much cash offshore, why they're selling out of the stock markets and moving their money, they simply respond, well, there is no profitable place to put your money in the United States. Banks aren't paying any interest. There aren't any companies out there that are show enough potential to make a return on an investment, so they say. Actually, there are thousands and thousands of small businesses every single year that would make fine investments for these $5.1 trillions. But that's what they've decided to do. So here are some of the other agrarious hoarders, according to the two analyses. Pfizer, $73 billion. Merck and Company, $53 billion. Johnson & Johnson, $49 billion. Sound familiar? These are the same stocks that Paulson and Buffett and Soros are dumping as fast as they can get it written up. Google, $33 billion. Devon Energy Corporation increased its offshore cash by 48% in 1 year. Occidental Petroleum, 47%. Oh, gee, who's a major shareholder in Occidental? Can you say Al Gore? That's right. Honeywell International, up 43% from 2011. Do they know something you don't know? No, because you listen to X Squared Radio. So, you know what's going on, and you should be doing the same thing that they're doing. Hold on one moment. Of course, it's difficult for you to do because you're not moving millions or billions. You have $10,000 in your investment account. You have a 401k, something that you've been contributing to for years and years and years, and your employer is matching it. Well, I have a story in the next hour that is going to raise the hair on the back of your neck, because what we have been talking about on this program for 6 months, preparing you very carefully, sort of like good sci-fi out there, to prepare you for what is about to happen, is now about to happen. So I want you to pay close attention in the next hour as we cover these stories. Now, I covered this in the very first hour of the hour, but some of you have just joined us. I know that it's tax season. A lot of you are filing your taxes now because you're getting a refund. If you're not getting a refund, well, you might put it off for a month or so, and that's okay too. But if you're getting a refund back, I'm sure you have everybody, including maybe some debtors or creditors, asking you to put that money toward them. I'm trying to give you some good advice here. I think you should click on the banner at x2-radio.com that says the food investor. You should invest in your own survival and those of your loved ones. My good friends Scott and Danny out in Utah have formed a new company. It's not brand new. It's been in business for a couple of years now, but they've developed a new food process that doesn't require any preservatives, retains the flavor in the food, and a preservation system that keeps this food for 30 years. It is truly a set it and forget it food. If you invest in food of this kind of quality, this kind of storage packaging, you could put it in a pack by the door. And if a disaster happens, you don't have to rely on the Federal Emergency Management Administration to take care of you. You won't have to stand in line for cookies and cold cocoa and a 3-foot by 3-foot thin blanket. You'll have your own supplies. You'll be able to feed yourself. And instead of eating lukewarm rice, you can eat a delicious, hot, well-preserved meal of your own. They're lightweight, they're cost-effective, and you can get them by going to x2-radio.com. That's the X Squared Radio official website. Go to the right-hand side of the screen, and you'll see right at the top of the affiliate list, the food investor. Give it a shot. I know you'll be satisfied with it. I am. All right. Coming up this October, I know it's only March, but you got to prepare for these things because sometimes it takes saving a little money and putting some thought aside for it. Something is about to change the way we light our homes, the way we drive our cars, the way we heat our homes or cook, or the way we store energy. It is an alternative way of doing these kinds of things. Where do you find out this information? You don't go to ComEx. No. You're not going to find out about it in Vegas. You have to go to the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. Now, have you seen the movie Atlas Shrugged? The first one, the second one? Have you read the book? Have you listened to any of the commentary? Well, movie number 3 is getting ready to come out. No, I haven't seen the trailer yet, but you're going to. If you go to the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Boulder, Colorado in October. Now, there's a link at X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com on the right-hand side that says Breakthrough Energy Movement right there on the right-hand side. Looks like a Flower of Life emblem in the shape of a planet. You click on that and you learn about this conference. Set your sights on Boulder, Colorado, and I want to see you there in October. I'm going to be there with the electric truck. And there's going to be other technology there from all over the world. Some of it you can buy. Some of it will give you ideas for developing your own alternative energy or storage device or a way to take yourself off the grid or at least be able to provide yourself lights, heat, energy without having to rub two sticks together. Because many people, and I'm one of them, think that this new centralized grid, although it seems to be great because they can move electricity from Yuma, Arizona to Bangor, Maine if they want to, it presents a lot of vulnerability. And the NERC, the National Energy Renewable Corporation, a regulatory commission, Electrical Reliability Corporation, NERC, also believes that because they have centralized the grid, they have exposed themselves to at least three major risks that would not be there without a centralized grid. Number one is a pandemic. What happens if the people that know how to run the grid aren't around? They're sick or they're dead. That's a really good question. They're trying to figure out how to manage that. The second one is physical or cyber attack. If somebody moves in, hacks into the computers that monitor or regulate or generate the electricity that spreads it around the country, they need a way to defend against that, or, God forbid, a physical attack. The third is natural disasters. This could come in the form of an earthquake, a fire, a tornado, or even a solar storm. The NERC is now having to address these issues by raising a tremendous amount of money and designing in contingencies. They're already working on it, and they're already collecting the money. The Breakthrough Energy Movement was exposed this last fall to an alternative idea to present to the world, and that is a low-voltage, non-centralized source of energy. I'm not talking about the 161,000 volts or the 275,000 volt high voltage that goes on the high tension lines around the country. I'm talking about a low voltage, 120 to 240 volts, just enough electricity to run one or two buildings, or even one or two operations inside those buildings. But the source of energy comes from an alternative method. Solar, wind, plasma, magnetics. You're going to see this kind of energy production at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. Believe me when I tell you, the finest people on the planet, the brightest minds with the highest integrity will be there. And you might as well be too. You need to see what can be done. It's sort of like if you were in Leonardo da Vinci's day. Sure, lots of people had drawings of birds. They had drawings of gliders and aircraft, but nobody'd flown. It would sort of be like taking 300 people from Da Vinci's day and bringing them forward to 1907 to watch Orville and Wilbur Wright fly their airplane around the Paris World's Fair. Everyone there would say, "Oh, that's how you do it." And everything changes after that. That's what I'm talking about. That's where we want you. That's where you should be. I'm going to be talking about this every week between now and then. You've got time. Start setting it aside. 20, 30 bucks a month. You can have it put together. And we'll see you in Boulder, Colorado in October. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing. archer split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Now, I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and we're sure glad that you're here with us. We encourage you to join us live by phone, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. It's free. Or anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. Now, in this hour, we had Neil Kramer on the program a couple of months ago. We've run the archive a couple of times as well because we felt that the program was so important. And the subject of discussion was the Second Amendment. Now, you might ask, why in the world did you have an Englishman on the program talking about the Second Amendment? Isn't that an American thing? And the answer is, yes, it is. But to have the perspective of someone who has lived through and with the disarming of a nation, that was important. That was an important perspective. You needed to hear it. And if you missed it, you need to go back and listen to that archive with Neil Kramer. So from time to time, we have found articles and perspectives that have backed up what we had talked about during that program. And recently, this is like 16 hours ago, a new bill that would ban lead ammunition in California has been passed. Now, Earth Explorers, you're talking to somebody who in, you know, a previous period of my life was a gun enthusiast in the sense that, of course, I was fascinated with, you know, the firearms, the mechanics of it, the accuracy of it, sort of like it was a poor man's video game in those days. And, you know, target shooting was fun and it was a challenge. You really get good at it. And I can tell you that there really aren't that many other forms of ammunition other than lead. Why? Well, because the gun barrels are steel. And so you need a somewhat softer metal in order to stand up to the riflings of the barrel itself, and also to be able to mush or mushroom when it hits a target, like if you're hunting a deer or if you know, you're shooting a target. You don't want a hardened steel slug to go right through. You want it to slow down and stay in the target. Well, environmentalists are pushing legislation to ban lead ammunition in California to prevent toxins from poisoning scavengers that eat animal remains left by hunters. I got to tell you, people, this is way out there. This is so fringe, I'm hardly able to read it. I want you to see through it with me. Final language of the bill was introduced Monday by Assemblymember Anthony Rendon, Democrat from Lakewood, who said the legislation would remove a lingering source of pollution from the environment. It was sponsored by three major environmental groups: Defenders of Wildlife, Audubon California, and the Humane Society of the United States. There's really no question that lead ammo is a threat, said Kim Delfino of Defenders of Wildlife. I guess that's opposed to sticks or rocks. Lead is a neurotoxin that has thwarted efforts to restore endangered California condors to their historic habitat. Yes, Kim, but that lead came from paint, okay? That lead came from gasoline, lead-based gasoline. Got it? That lead was actually anti-knocking agent that was added to the gasoline so that high-compression engines could burn gasoline smoothly. When the lead came out of the exhaust pipe, it floated into the atmosphere, and then rain took it into the soil, which softened the eggshells of the California condor and almost drove it to extinction. It didn't happen from bullets, because we're talking about two different oxidation states of lead, Kim. She maintains it's the major cause of death for condors and affects other scavengers such as bald eagles, golden eagles, and turkey vultures. Again, Kim, wrong oxidation state of lead. Opponents of restrictions on ammunition purchases argue that animals that suffer from lead poisoning could be getting it from another source. Duh. They cite the fact that incidences of poisoning have not declined despite a ban since 2008 on the use of lead ammunition in the 8-county area where condor recovery is underway. The National Rifle Association has opposed all bans on lead ammo in the past because, well, they haven't had any success making ammo out of bubblegum. The gun rights group has dismissed studies from the University of California, Davis, and the University of California, Santa Cruz, that show poisonings of birds of prey are highest during hunting seasons and that the lead isotopes in their bloodstream match ammunition. The NRA says those studies are flawed. NRA officials did not immediately return telephone messages seeking comment on the new bill. Studies have shown that non-lead ammunition fires as accurately, but in some calibers it is more expensive than bullets made of lead. Proponents of the ban argue that as non-lead ammo becomes more popular with hunters, the prices will continue to decrease. The bill comes as a subcommittee of the California Fish and Game Commission is studying whether to institute a ban statewide. It's only the beginning, people. It's only the beginning. The commission has looked at the lead issue for years, said Michael Sutton, the department's president. Should we ban it on state lands, ecological areas, and preserves for all hunting statewide? I'm not going to hazard a guess as to what the commission will do. Oh, of course not. Bill supporters, including pediatrician Richard Pan, a Democrat from Sacramento, say lead shot in animals consumed by humans is a public health issue because it puts children at risk of brain damage. We don't have to choose between hunting and protecting wildlife, said Jennifer Fearing of the Humane Society of the United States. Removing lead from the environment isn't just good science. It's also the right thing to do. Oh, there you go. That's the famous presidential quote. It's the right thing to do. What do you think? To lead or not to lead? 888-429-5471. I don't know, folks. I don't think an aluminum slug is going to carry too far. All right, we're going to go ahead and give a Wars R Us update. It's going to consume the rest of this hour. I suggest you don't turn away because you haven't heard this in the mainstream news, and you probably have not heard it in the alternative news because very few people connect the dots the way we do here. And I don't mean that we do a unique way. We try to use a straight line and a ruler. It's doesn't look like a spider web when we do it, okay? We try to pull everything together so that you can see how it lines up. Because all the news stories are out there. And they might be in the fringe. They might be in the margins. They might be late at night. They might be only online newspapers. But when you grab all the stories and you put them together, you really get a clear picture. And, of course, this is where the past meets the future. Right here. This is it. This is the interface. And we want you to keep up. So you can still loosen the seatbelt a little bit. That's fine. But here we go. This is our Wars R Us update. North Korea on Thursday. This is Sunday. We're talking about the same week. Okay? North Korea on Thursday vowed to launch a preemptive nuclear strike against the United States, amplifying its threatening rhetoric hours ahead of a vote by UN diplomats on whether to level new sanctions against Pyongyang for its recent nuclear test. In the hours between Thursday and this morning, North Korea launched a test missile into the Bay of Japan. It didn't have anything in it. But that's a little bit more than saber-rattling, people. It dropped a giant aluminum can in the Bay of Japan. Just to say, if we wanted to, an unidentified spokesman for Pyongyang's foreign ministry said the North will exercise its right for a preemptive nuclear attack to destroy the strongholds of the aggressors because Washington is pushing to start a nuclear war against the North. Although North Korea boasts of nuclear bombs and preemptive strikes, it is not thought to have mastered the ability to produce a warhead small enough to put on a missile capable of reaching the U.S. It is believed to have enough nuclear fuel, however, for several crude nuclear devices. Such inflammatory rhetoric is common from North Korea, and especially so in recent days. North Korea is angry over the possible sanctions and over upcoming U.S.-South Korea military drills. At a mass rally in Pyongyang on Thursday, tens of thousands of North Koreans protested the U.S.-South Korean war drills and sanctions. Well, there's a lot more to it than this. The U.S. and South Korea are doing the drills. They have done the drills since the 1950s. They have also deployed an anti-missile shield mechanism. Some of it is in the form of submarines. Some of it is in the form of platforms that are placed into international waters to act as a missile shield should North Korea launch anything our way. The Korean Peninsula is in a unique position to be particularly pesky to a lot of, let's call them allies of the United States. One of the statements that was made about a month ago from China is that they were going to attack not the U.S. No, no. They were going to attack four U.S. allies, Vietnam, Malaysia, Taiwan, and possibly even the islands of outside of Japan, which are in, shall we say, arbitration between China and Japan as to who owns them, who controls them, who has the rights to them. Now, the gamble is that a country as big as China can flex its muscle and can go in and take a preemptive strike and even occupy those areas. and the U.S. won't do a darn thing about it. And I think you agree with that. And I think probably the press agrees with that too. So the question is, what do the folks down at Wars R Us have to say about this? Well, I have this link I'm going to play for you, and you can hear for yourself. Be prepared, people. Be prepared.
The right to a preemptive nuclear strike against China is now part of U.S. law. That's thanks to the National Defense Authorization Act. The Pentagon's also ordered a thorough review of when and how the U.S. could strike at the network of tunnels believed to hold Beijing's atomic arsenals. We better get into this right now. James Corbett joins us live on the program, editor of a Japan-based news website. Mr. Corbett, a pleasure to see you. Thanks for coming on so quickly. The U.S. government is operating on the assumption that there are 3,000 miles worth of tunnels crisscrossing China, allegedly containing 3,000 nuclear warheads. Do you believe it?
Well, I'm not even sure that the U.S. government really believes it. This is really on the back of a study that was commissioned out of Georgetown University last year, or 2 years ago now, that found that in this network of tunnels that we do know exist, and we can see from satellite telemetry, we do know that these tunnels exist, and it's just sheer speculation about what exists within them at this point. U.S. intelligence estimates puts the Chinese nuclear arsenal something like 300. But this study out of Georgetown in 2011 estimated that it could house as many as 3,000 nuclear warheads. So basically, as part of the NDA 2013, they're basically saying that now the Stratcom is going to have to commission a report to identify the potential problems involved in this and whether or not they'll be able to actually confront this with conventional or even nuclear forces in the event that they actually need to
Assessing how big are these tunnels, how many warheads are in this tunnel. The previous reports had said 300, not 3,000. Now, we've got most of America's ballistic submarine fleet operating in the Pacific. We've also got more U.S. ships moving in that area. The Pentagon all the while promising to contain China and now planning for what they say a possible nuclear strike. Well, that's not exactly going to help already strained relations, is it?
It really isn't. I don't think that we have to look at this report in the context of they're going to move in with a nuclear strike right at this point. But I think it has to be seen as a wider part of U.S. nuclear policy that's been stretching out for decades now, trying to come up with ways to justify the existence of some of the U.S.'s existing nuclear arsenal and looking for ways to create new weapons. So, for example, we have the B-61-11 nuclear bunker busters with a 400 kiloton yield that they've been harboring and talking about for the better part of a decade now in relation to Iran and trying to bust through into Iran's underground nuclear facilities or alleged nuclear facilities. Now they're just shifting that rhetoric over to the Asia-Pacific as part of this Asia-Pacific pivot. I think to a certain extent, this is just to justify the existence of the U.S. arsenal and to make sure that things like the new START, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, basically gets scuttled before it really gets off the ground. And there's a lot in this new NDAA that really seeks to undermine the president's ability, should he ever want to actually reduce the nuclear stockpile. So I think the Congress is definitely trying to get their foot in the door and stop any types of arms reductions before it can actually be implemented.
There are certainly some that really say that the American president is powerless when it comes to going head-to-head with the military-industrial complex. Certainly at this point, though, we've been getting reports that there have been some rather peculiar high-altitude jet forays between China and Japan. Some Japanese jets tailing Chinese jets, basically playing some high-altitude games of cat and mouse, possibly reigniting another territorial dispute. They've been having disputes for quite some time now, certainly over some particular islands. Is it possible that those two could get involved in something slightly more intense?
It certainly could, and of course, the more bellicose that the U.S. becomes against China, the more safe Japan will feel in either threatening or responding to Chinese aggression. So I think it really only serves to put a match next to this powder keg that is the Asia-Pacific region, especially now that that really this is heating up and that the American attention is turning here. I think we're going to see more and more of this type of these types of situations coming along that could justify even further military intervention. So we have to look at these types of nuclear rhetoric that's coming out right now, not necessarily as an attempt to strike anytime soon, but certainly something to keep our eyes on as this rhetoric continues to ratchet up.
Well, as you well know, Mr. Corbett, the U.S. has been increasing its military presence in the Asia-Pacific region for quite some time now, certainly over the past 2 years, increasing it in somewhat called fairly drastic measures. Now a report of them examining possibly 3,000 miles loaded with nuclear warheads crisscrossing China. I'm sure certainly at the very least conspiracy theorists are going to have a field day with this. James Corbett.
All right. Well, you know, we're not trying to be conspiracy theorists here. We're just trying to keep you alert. Now, when I was a young boy, living in Southern California, we did our stop, drop, and roll. We hid under our desks during nuclear attack drills. And we heard the emergency broadcast announcements, the practice announcements that came over that got us in our elementary schools to hide up against the walls and stay away from the windows. And I was in the Air Force in the early 70s. And we went through our drills and were convinced that our base could take not one, but probably two direct hits, with most of us still surviving. I realize now that that was highly doubtful. But rhetoric is hardly the word to use here, and that's the word that news organizations are beginning to use. It's because what they're trying to do is make you aware that these tensions are mounting. That when leaders begin to speak in these kinds of terms, it's not done lightly. Even though the red button is always there, we don't like to think about it, and we haven't thought about it for a long time. Our weapons are so accurate and so precise and so powerful that we don't have to think about those kinds of things. But our enemies often do. And our enemies, sometimes smaller or sometimes just as large but maybe less organized, have to come to the nuclear weapons table in order to be considered legitimate, a la Iran. A nation of about 65 million people is trying to belly up to the table of legitimate world powers by saying that they're going to develop a nuclear weapon. Are they? Well, it's clear that they have a research program. It's clear that they're trying to get into the nuclear power business, and that often means, especially with the equipment that they have bought and have developed, that they are breeding enriched uranium, which is also used for fissile weapons and for fusion weapons. That's the kind of thing we really don't like to see fall into the hands of terrorists, because it's not like blowing up a bunch of TNT. It ruins that day and many days to come if they're able to pull it off. Now, we have already talked about China making threats against several of U.S. Smaller allies like Vietnam, Malaysia, Taiwan. As you remember, last year we talked about the U.S. shipping weapons to Taiwan, China retaliating by selling off short-term bonds, much to its own consternation, by the way, kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face. But nevertheless, they did it. It hurt the United States as well by selling off that debt. At the same time, Japan was trying to recover from its issues with Fukushima. And as we will cover later on when we talk about the upcoming bank collapse, which we want you to prepare for as well, Japan was not in a position to pick up that debt, and so it was picked up by, well, the Federal Reserve, which, as you know, really doesn't have any money. They just kind of print money. And then we have this rhetoric, which I am about to add. I say rhetoric. I really don't want to claim that it's rhetoric. This is the kind of thing that when we see it casually in the news, sometimes it's easy to let it go by. But I think in the interest of preparation, we want to keep you informed, and so it's important that you hear this. Now, this is video. You won't be able to see it, and I'm going to translate on account of it's dubbed in English, in print, underscored in English. I'm going to read the English part when the Russian is speaking. But as if China and North Korea are not enough, there's Russia entering into the fray in almost classic Soviet style. Here we go.
If the events of this past week were to communicate one thing loud and clear, it is that the time for Glass-Steagall, national banking, and NWAPA has come. But with Barack Obama in the White House, the time that still exists to enact those policies may be swiftly cut short by the thermonuclear conflict with Russia that Obama is committed to. Just yesterday, Russian Prime Minister Medvedev warned unequivocally that nations seeking to usurp the national sovereignty of any nation, especially theirs, that nuclear war is indeed on the table for any such violation.
Это реалии, с которыми мы все должны считаться. И государственной власти придется дать на этот запрос свой, надеюсь, эффективный ответ. Так.
Okay, I said I was going to translate this because I was going to play the video. And I didn't play the video. I played the audio. So let me see if I can go find the video very quickly. No worries. Just hang in there. It'll just take me a second to find. And I'm going to read you the Russian's words because I think it's important that you hear exactly what he is saying. One thing to hear the commentary. It's another to actually, you know, see what is being said in print. So hold on one second here. I'm almost there. I'm at the video, and I'm not finding it. So that's the audio, and I suppose I could play it to you. Let's see here. I think I probably already deleted the video because it takes up too much space in my hard drive. All right. Well, let's go ahead and play it because it's important to hear this part. Hold on one second. I know where I put it. Don't you love this? This is what really live radio is all about, because we try to find these things as quickly as we can and put them in place so that so you can hear and see everything that's going on. And I'm not finding it. Don't you love it? I just love this job. It's so much fun, everything we do. All right, let's go back to the audio. We'll play that for you. Some of it is LPAC, which is LaRoche's website. But still, it's pretty important that you listen to the translation, and it's going to be played for you here in just a second, so hang in there. Here we go.
If on nuclear conflict with Russia that Obama is committed to. Just yesterday, Russian Prime Minister Medvedev warned unequivocally that nations seeking to usurp the national sovereignty of any nation, especially theirs, that nuclear war is indeed on the table for any such violation.
Это реалии, с которыми мы все должны считаться. И государственной власти придется дать на этот запрос свой,
now, this надеюсь, is the Prime Minister, Medvedev,
доктрина
so...
государственного суверенитета. Она не должна размываться, даже если это удобно для достижения каких-то текущих политических целей, вплоть до цели избраться на соответствующую позицию. Это просто опасно для мирового порядка. А примеров посягательств на доктрину суверенитета в последние годы было очень немало. Чего стоят и военные операции против иностранных государств в обход Организации Объединенных Наций, заявление о том, что тот или иной политический режим потерял легитимность, причем заявление со стороны иностранных государств, а не со стороны народа соответствующей страны, введение всяческих коллективных санкций в обход международных институтов. Все это не улучшает ситуацию в мире, а последствия скоропалительных военных операций в иностранных государствах обычно заканчивается одним – приходом к власти радикалов. Я уже не говорю, что в какой-нибудь момент такие действия, которые подрывают государственный суверенитет, могут закончиться вполне себе такой полноценной региональной войной. И даже, никого не хочу пугать, с применением ядерного оружия. Об этом должны помнить все.
This statement is an obvious message directed to the Obama administration indirectly and the financial power that controls it. Since the illegal war launched in Libya last year and even the more unlawful assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, The administration has done nothing but show a disgusting abuse of executive power and criminal disregard for domestic and international law, a disregard that nations like Russia and even high-level U.S. military officials view as threats to national sovereignty. Russia has repeatedly stated that that is the issue over military intervention in Syria and Iran. Sovereignty. That is the issue at stake with all the threats occurring at this point. And beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's what's at stake with the joint U.S.-NATO anti-ballistic missile system being built in Europe aimed at Russia. Despite Obama's irrational commitment to war, saner elements in the United States have mounted in and around the U.S. military. Specifically, Representative Walter Jones, in his push for legislation HCR 107, declares that any president who launches war without congressional approval would be immediately subject to impeachment. This was followed by Senator Jim Webb in a restatement he made on the same point in the Senate in his piece of legislation,
by the way,
S-3176, to try to stop a preemptive illegal war. So far, they stand virtually alone, and that in and of itself increases the danger of nuclear war. While Jones's and Webb's legislation is despicably still outstanding in both houses of Congress, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a resolution on Iran that moves the United States much closer to a war footing against Iran. And as many experts and diplomats like Dan Shapiro, the envoy to Israel from the United States, warn, America is ready to attack. The non-binding resolution, H.R. 568, that overwhelmingly passed 401-11, effectively calls for a military attack on Iran when it obtains nuclear weapons capability. The vague interpretation already applies to Iran and actually any other country with a civilian nuclear program, and comes at a time when Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak is actively urging the international community to increase pressure on Syria, as he says, to strike a further blow to Iran. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff for the Secretary of State Colin Powell, warned that this resolution reads like the same sheet music that got us into the Iraq War and could be the precursor for a war with Iran. It's effectively a thinly disguised effort to bless war. General Wilkerson is right, and if his and others' warnings are not heeded, whether it's concerning Iran, Syria, or Russia directly, the United States will have violated the rights of a sovereign nation, whose consequences was spelled out by Medvedev yesterday. Those consequences being a thermonuclear war, threatening the annihilation of the entire human species. That is President Obama's commitment. Therefore, there is no discussion of war avoidance policy that does not include removing Barack Obama from office. We have been warned, and the way things are looking now, we will not get another one.
There's a second piece.
The British Empire's game, run through U.S. President Barack Obama, has been called out by the Russian government. They do not want it, but if pushed, will go to war. It will be thermonuclear war. Therefore, what humanity faces in light of the Obama administration's go-ahead to make the ballistic missile defense system operational based on the completion of Phase 1 on May 20th is possible extinction. Is it inevitable? Only if Barack Obama is not taken out of power. Because if Obama succeeds in his mad drive to force Russia into thermonuclear confrontation, there can be no economic recovery, domestic or international. There will be, possibly, no humanity left on the face of this earth.
And we are trying to
reach that life depends on the constitutional elimination of his power. Today, on May 17th, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev in the presence of U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder.
That would be March 17th.
Reiterated Russia's position that the drive coming from the U.S. acting as the geopolitical muscle of the British royal family can easily lead to nuclear confrontation. Medvedev stated, "There have been many recent examples of the concept of state sovereignty being undermined. Military operations against foreign states bypassing the United Nations, declarations of illegitimacy of certain political regimes. This does not improve the situation in the world, while rash military interference in the affairs of another state usually results in radicals coming to power."
And such we've certainly seen that.
"Which undermine state sovereignty can easily lead to full-scale regional war, even, I am not trying to scare anyone here, with the use of nuclear weapons." Member of the LaRouche PAC endorsed national slate of congressional candidates, Keisha Rogers of the 22nd District of Texas, delivered a sharp message on May 15th while organizing on the ground in Texas that the threat of thermonuclear confrontation with Russia, which we just heard Medvedev warn about, can only be stopped with the nullifying of Obama's powers.
"And I will just say that the message that's being sent from Russia and from what we're seeing with the attempts and the drive toward World War III is very clear to Russia and very clear to our U.S. military. The solution is we have to get Obama out now. We have to stop this collapse. And everything that you have to put into this fight. Let's send a message, clear message to the White House. Obama must go. Let's take the nation back, and we can win this fight for mankind. Thank you."
As it stands, Barack Obama has been rejected by the American people. There is no response that will come from this administration on the collapse of the entire world financial system. All American citizens can expect from the Obama Party is a showdown of thermonuclear confrontation with Russia.
Well, we would hope not to see that. That is talk and rhetoric that we have not heard since I was a young kid living in Southern California. We don't like to hear it. We don't like to see it, but we are hearing it. We are seeing it in all kinds of venues, both online and in the mainstream news. No one wants to see this kind of conflict, but when we see that China is involved, North Korea is involved, Russia is involved, the U.S. is involved, Iran is involved, and of course mixed all in there in the middle is Israel involved, and you heard the word Israel used several times by the prime minister from Russia, all of this plays a part. And then this week we heard sharp denunciation from Russia about the discovery that the U.S. CIA and special forces are training Syrian rebels in Jordan and then sending them back into Syria. This is the kind of meddling. This is the kind of activity that these two nations are talking about. Now, as if this isn't strange enough, it's kind of a throwback to the Twilight Zone almost as we talk about thermonuclear war. It's sort of like, going back to war games. You remember the late 1980s one with Matthew Broderick in it. Just crazy thoughts of launching nuclear weapons at one another. It just doesn't seem possible in this day of instant communication and hopefully better sanity. But as if that is not enough, blended in with this is a climate change update. And this is really going to blow your mind. It did mine. America's top military officer in charge of monitoring hostile actions by North Korea, escalating tensions between China and Japan, and a spike in computer attacks traced to China, provides an unexpected answer when asked what is the biggest long-term security threat in the Pacific region. This is going to kind of blow your mind. Navy Admiral Samuel J. Locklear III in an interview at a Cambridge hotel 2 days ago, Friday, after he met with scholars at Harvard and Tufts universities, said significant upheaval related to the warming planet is probably the most likely thing that is going to happen. That will cripple the security environment, probably more likely than the other scenarios we all often talk about. People are surprised sometimes, he added, describing the reaction to his assessment. You have the real potential here in the not-too-distant future of nations displaced by rising sea level. Certainly, weather patterns are more severe than they have been in the past. We are on Super Typhoon 27 or 28 this year in the Western Pacific. The average is about 17. Locklear said his Hawaii-based headquarters, which is assigned more than 400,000 military and civilian personnel, and is responsible for operations from California to India, is working with Asian nations to stockpile supplies in strategic locations and planning a major exercise for May with nearly two dozen countries to practice the what-ifs. Locklear's two-day visit to New England, which included meetings with students at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, coincides with the Obama administration's recent pivot to Asia, the recalibration of national security strategy after more than a decade of war in the Middle East to reemphasize a region with rising military and economic powers such as China and India, and where most U.S. trade links are. In the closed-door discussions Thursday and Friday, Locklear met with security and foreign policy specialists, including the Harvard Kennedy School's Graham Allison, who directs the Belfair Center for Science and International Affairs, and Asia specialist Joseph Nye, Jr. Nye said he briefed Locklear on a trip he made last fall at the behest of the Department of State to meet with the top leaders of China and Japan to urge them to peacefully settle disputes over islands in the South and East China Seas. China last month was accused of directing one of its Navy radars at a Japanese warship near the islands where both countries assert sovereignty and claims to fishing and mineral rights. It came several weeks after Japan said China took similar action with one of its military helicopters. We have an ongoing number of disputes, Locklear said. It's not just about China and everybody else, because there are disputes between other parties down there, too. Sometimes I think the Chinese get handled a little too roughly on this. What we are concerned about most, he added, is that they work through these things. A larger concern is North Korea, which in recent days has threatened to launch a nuclear weapon against the United States. Pardon me while I yawn. Following Pyongyang's recent long-range missile launch and underground nuclear test, the United States Security Council on Thursday voted unanimously to tighten sanctions on the reclusive communist regime. In response, the North Korean government threatened to nullify its non-aggression pacts with South Korea, where the United States maintains a military presence. Frankly, most of my friends, most of my associates in South Korea and in the military who have served and do serve in South Korea think that that kind of conflict would last about 47 minutes. Locklear said North Korea's military has taken recent steps to visibly increase their levels of readiness along the demilitarized zone that has separated the two Koreas since the armistice halting the Korean War in 1953. We are watching very closely what's going on, and we are prepared to defend the alliance as well as our homeland, he said. In the interview, he stressed the need for a global set of guidelines for the internet and cyberspace, which he called the modern version of the 19th century's Wild West, where the only security you brought with you was what you carried on you. We made cyberspace as kind of an ungoverned territory, and we haven't been able to get our arms around how to govern it yet, Locklear added, which is kind of a neat way of saying we haven't learned how to rule it yet. But when it comes to pragmatic military planning, Locklear said he is increasingly focused on another high destabilizing force. The ice is melting, and sea is getting higher, Locklear said, noting that 80% of the world's population lives within 200 miles of the coast. Actually, it's within 30 miles of the coast. I'm into the consequence management side of it. I'm not a scientist, but the island of Tarawa in Kiribati, they're contemplating moving their entire population to another country because it's not going to exist anymore. The U.S. military, he said, is beginning to watch out to other armed forces in the region about the issue. We have interjected into our multilateral dialogue, even with China and India, the imperative to kind of get military capabilities aligned for when the effects of climate change start to impact these massive populations, he said. If it goes bad, you could have hundreds of thousands or millions of people displaced, and then security will start to crumble pretty quickly. Navy Admiral Samuel J. Locklear III. Oh, let's see. Hang on a second. I just copied the same thing over again twice. All right. So that's what you, where you have it. You have the Admiral saying that the greatest threat to security in the region is climate change. Now you have the twist upon twists. You have China, you have Russia, you have North Korea, you have Vietnam, Malaysia, Taiwan, Japan, and now climate change, all mixed into it. Now you see how this rhetoric gets just amazingly convoluted and twisted. Any thoughts out there? 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. It's a complicated, shall we call it an algorithm. Each country has its own concerns, has its own saber to rattle. The question is why. The question is what do they want to gain? Now, think about this for a moment. China is the world's creditor, right? They're getting payments from nations all over the world because China has loaned them money, and China is charging interest, and those countries are making payments on that interest, and some of them are actually paying down their debt. Not many, but some. That means that China has money to burn. China has money to spend, and they're turning around and investing that money right back in the very countries with whom they are carrying the debt. How are they doing that? Well, I'm glad you asked. They're investing in businesses in those countries. The Chinese have an active program called the EB-5 program. Have you heard of it? If so, give me a call, 888-429-5471. Let me tell you a little bit about the EB-5 program. This is an investment program where the Chinese will invest money into an American business if that business promises to hire Chinese nationals in that business. Now, some of it might be construction, but most of it is going to be engineering, it's going to be labor. In other words, China doesn't have enough jobs for its own people. It has to support all its own people because, after all, it is a communist nation. So when you go over there and look at a factory where a job will require one person, they'll have four or five, and each one of those people will do a portion of the job. They'll be provided housing and food by the company, and oftentimes clothing as well. But they don't get any time off. Many times they have to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, to keep up with demand. The Chinese turn around and build mega cities like Jiangsu City, which is a fairly new city, $800 million American dollars spent to develop that city. Large factories like Kia and Sanyo and other companies like that exist there to build components, automobiles, subcomponents, but there are no people in these factories. A few people here and there, and that's about it. So, are they moving people from the countryside into the cities? Yes, they are. Why would they be doing that? Because now, with more and more machinery being able to run larger and larger farms, the people are needed in the factories. people want to have good-paying jobs so that they can put their kids through college, same thing as other families want. And those kinds of jobs only exist in the city, not on the farms. The other thing that China does is they export their population to other countries like Tibet, Nepal, Egypt, around places like that. And those workers and engineers will take jobs in that country. They also marry into those populations. Effectively, it's an ancient trick the British used to use, try to kind of breed out the population and make it less aggressive toward their concerns, more sympathetic toward their concerns. So the EB-5 program is a system like that. It allows them to find jobs for their people elsewhere in the world, and they use their money sort of as a job stimulation program. Now, the interesting thing about the EB-5 program in the United States is you have to have a permit. You have to have a certificate that's issued by them, that's approved by the state. Those permits are owned by certain individuals who are well-connected. In some of the cases, they're connected to the Clintons. In some of the cases, they're connected to other Democrat senators and congressmen. It's interesting to note how that power is delineated. The EB-5 program brings money into the state, creating jobs in those areas where those constituencies might be strengthened, thus perpetuating power in certain political parties. I know this for a fact. I'm not making it up. I can back it up. If anyone has any comments on it, you can let me know. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Got names, got dates, got places. If you're interested, I can give you the information. Now, let's go ahead and shift gears because I want to get off into some science stuff for 20, 30 minutes, and then I want to talk to you about the upcoming banking problems that we're going to see. I want to do this because it's important to you. It's important to me because I want to make sure that you are protected, that you're able to save yourself and your families. Now, physicists say that they have found a Higgs boson. A lot of you are going, what the heck is a Higgs boson? Well, the search is over. Well, it's all but over for a subatomic particle that is a crucial building block of the universe. It's often called the God particle. Physicists announced Thursday of this week that they believe they have discovered the subatomic particle that predicted nearly half a century ago, which will go a long way toward explaining what gives electrons and all matter in the universe size and shape. In other words, how did the third dimension ever come to be? The elusive particle, called a Higgs boson, was predicted in 1964 to help fill in our understanding of the creation of the universe, which many theorize occurred in a massive explosion known as the Big Bang, which could be a situation comedy on television, and then again, it could never have happened. We'll discuss that here just a little bit. The particle was named for Peter Higgs, one of the physicists who proposed its existence, but it later became popularly known as the God particle. The discovery would be a strong contender for the Nobel Prize. Last July, scientists at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, announced finding a particle they describe as Higgs-like. But they stopped short of saying conclusively that it was the same particle or was some version of it. Scientists have now finished going through the entire set of data. And here's what they say. The preliminary results with the full 2012 data set are magnificent. And to me, it is clear that we are dealing with a Higgs boson. Though we still have a long way to go to know what kind of Higgs boson it is, said Joe Incandela, a physicist who heads one of the two main teams at CERN, each involving several thousand scientists. Whether or not it is a Higgs boson is demonstrated by how it interacts with other particles and its quantum properties, CERN said in the statement. After checking, scientists said The results were announced in a statement by Geneva-based CERN and released at a physics conference in the Italian Alps. CERN's Atom Smasher, which, by the way, is about 27 kilometers in diameter. This is really a huge triple, like racetrack kind of collider, where it speeds up by adding energy to hydrogen protons, getting them up to about 0.99 the speed of light, and adding in the, I would say tera electron volts. Normally these exist at 1 electron volt. In the tera electron volts as far as mass, and then slamming them into each other and watching them fly apart in front of a detector array capable of picking up these frequencies. Now, the $10 billion Large Hadron Collider that lies beneath the Swiss-French border near Geneva has been creating high-energy collisions of protons to investigate how the universe came to be the way it is. The particle's existence helps confirm the theory that objects gain their size and shape when particles interact in an energy field with a key particle, the Higgs boson. The more they attract, so the theory goes, the bigger their mass will be. Now, the whole idea behind the Big Bang is sort of like all this mass gets jammed into a small space, say about the size of a proton, the whole universe. And it becomes impossible for mass or energy or light or anything else to escape from it, sort of like a gigantic singularity, black hole. Higgs theorized that in the compression of this, some of the energy kind of hangs back, like trying to wad up a bunch of Velcro. All those hooks and all those loops get entangled with one another. And as small as you try to crush this thing, there is still some energy that holds on, like a giant rubber band, all twisted up in this, but stretched to its maximum. And somewhere in the probabilities, that rubber band snaps. And the energy released from that snap is so powerful that it causes the black hole to explode. Now, when it explodes, all that matter gets shoved out into a much larger volume, which means its speed begins to increase. Its mass begins to increase. And when it gets to a certain size, some of these particles, like the Velcro I was talking about, cause it to start coagulating. Energy drops from one dimension into another dimension, the third dimension. And three-dimensional particles begin to form from pure energy. We call them strings or planes or membranes. They tend to form three basic particles, protons, electrons, and then from a combination of those two, neutrons. Inside of each one of these particles are subatomic particles. We call them bosons. The Higgs boson is sort of like the organizer, pulls all these pieces together. One of the strings, we call it a graviton, or sort of like the voice of God, pulls these things together to form these particles. Now, the interesting thing about the particles is they're kind of a hologram. That is to say, 90% of the data looks just like 100% of the data, only a little fainter, just not quite filled in enough. Part of a proton is the same thing as a full proton, but a proton is a proton is a proton, so to speak. They have different kinds of mass, hydrogen being the most dense, iron being the least dense, and then up into the higher grades of nuclides, they sort of climb gently across the weight scale. But protons and neutrons and electrons all react basically in very predictable manner. We don't have different kinds of matter from one side of the universe to the other, unless it's what you call antimatter and regular matter. Of course, when the two come together, they annihilate one another and turn into pure energy. The interesting thing about this whole mess, this whole organization, this whole function is that this is the only kind of universe that can form. We don't have different kinds of universes out there with different kinds of protons, different kinds of neutrons, or different kinds of subatomic particles. This is the only kind of universe that can coagulate out of pure energy. So when you look out there across all the dark energy and dark matter and regular matter that makes up the universe, only about 5% of it is actually visible or third dimensional. Over 94% of it certainly is this non-visible or non-physical matter, nevertheless very massive. So let's talk about it a little bit. Jake from Florida, line one, let's talk about it. What's on your mind?
Well, yeah, I actually wanted to talk about something you were just talking about a second ago, you know, as far as like terrorism and stuff goes. The late Dr. Fred Bell used to say back on his August 13, 2005 Coast to Coast AM interview that one of the keys to fighting terrorism in and of itself is actually raising consciousness. And I was wondering just a couple of things. My question for you is kind of multifaceted. I'm wondering if you're familiar with Dr. Bell's work. Do you know any information? What's that?
I know Fred. Yeah, I used to live in Laguna Beach. Really, really genius guy.
Genius, absolute mastermind inventor. I actually wanted to ask you about a couple of his inventions and stuff like that and their relationship to fighting terrorism. What about the nuclear receptor in the holographic technology? Are you able to tell me any information about that that's able to, you know, if it's possible to talk about that type of stuff? And I'll actually, Brooks, I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you, sir.
Well, I appreciate the question so much, Jake. Thank you very much. Dr. Fred Bell was such a genius, and he worked off of resonance with energy. Now, I don't claim to be an absolute expert on his technology, but some of the technology that he used you could actually wear, and some of it you would set up around the household. The sacred geometry with which it was built and the gems and metals that were used to make these instruments would pick up on energy that was in the environment, which a lot of it is negative, coming from very dark hearts or coming from other energy sources like HARP or radio waves like cell phones and TVs and all these kinds of harmful things that would sort of harsh your way of living. And it would create a destructive interference field around you or around your home, only letting the beneficial energy or higher consciousness energy into your body. And what it would do is it would raise your level of being able to interact with those things without being dragged down yourself. Now, his general theory, and I've spoke many hours with Dr. Fred Bell, and of course he was a regular host on BBS Radio Network for a long time, was that he felt that if he could get enough of this technology out there and enough of his ideas out there in pockets around the world, that it would create these kind of bright spots, these areas of higher consciousness where they just couldn't be dragged down. And it would thwart the goal of the enemy or of the dark ones to drag down or to control humanity. And that this was the real key to eliminating terrorism. Now, when I wrote my book, Alienated Nation, not to take away from the subject at all, I claimed that the key to world peace was Amelie's hot chocolate. And I wasn't being completely facetious about that. Something about realizing how wonderful, how beautiful it is to be immortal on this planet at this time with something as delicious as Amelie's hot chocolate warmly going over your lower lip and down your throat. You can think of nothing violent. You could think of not harming another human being. It's the furthest thing from your mind. As your eyes roll back in your head and your taste buds caress your body into absolute ecstasy from the inside out, it truly leaves you with a peaceful feeling. That's what I'm talking about. That's the kind of technology that Dr. Fred Bell would bring to you. As you wore his technology or you were in the presence of his technology, you had that kind of feeling. You had that kind of feeling when you were in his presence, when you were talking to him. You couldn't get down because he was so positive all the time. And I posthumously give him credit for perhaps establishing a world peace trend, which may have changed the course of history. Because I can tell you, just from what I've read, from what I know, that the organizations out there like the Bilderbergs and the Illuminati and all the kind of organizations that you think about, they want to manipulate all of us. They want to rule all of us. They want to tell us what to wear, what to eat, where to live, how many children to have, and what to think. But they're not able to do it because there are bright spots. There are points of light that are showing up all over the planet, and they have to do with awareness, consciousness, choice, and sovereignty. So thank you very much, Jake, for the question. Thank you for letting me at least mention one of the greatest scientists and I think innovators in the science of energy science relative to human biology that I've ever known. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with the third hour of X Squared Radio right after this.
I hardly know your name, and if I say I love you in the candlelight, there's no one but myself to blame. But there's something inside that's turning my mind away. If I could let you stay, it's love. I don't believe it deep inside. It's love. Is it just my sickly pride? Even now the feeling seems to steal away. So late. Though I'm crying, I can hardly hear you say, it's love.
favorite song by them. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you almost live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. We've been on BBS Radio Network for almost 8 years. This September will make 8 years. We have talked to millions of people all over the world, all kinds of nations, all kinds of walks of life. In all those 8 years, we have never, ever been knocked off the air until tonight. You're listening to this as an archive because this hour did not go out live. No one knows what's going on. But if for the first time in my 8 years at BBS Radio, we're off the air. That doesn't mean that we're out of business because you're listening to this as an archive or you're listening to it on the BBS Radio conference line. Call your friends and tell them, yes, the radio feed is off, but the conference line is live, 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then dial the passcode 769-608-pound, 769-608-pound. You can find that number at bbsradio.com or at x2-radio.com. That's our X Squared Radio site. So I'll give you a minute to kind of catch up because the news I'm about to give you, the advice I'm about to give you, is critical. As you calculate your taxes this year, you may end up with a refund. I know there are lots of things competing for those few hundred or few thousand dollars that you're going to get back, but I'm going to ask you to invest that money. No, don't invest it in stocks. I want you to invest it in food. Go to x2-radio.com and click on the banner on the right-hand side at the very top that says The Food Investor. My friends, Scott and Danny, out in Utah, have developed a food preservation process that does not use preservatives. Okay? That means that you get delicious flavor. You get the food preserved for 30 years in a lightweight packaging that you can throw into a backpack, put into a closet, and you can save it for that day when you have to grab it and go. Don't be a burden on FEMA. Don't rely on them to give you cookies and cocoa and a warm blanket. You can take care of yourself and the ones you love by investing today in food. The Food Investor at x2-radio.com. Now, we have about 40 minutes left, and I'm going to cover this subject matter, which we talk about from time to time, and that is banking. Now, one of the things that we wrote about a couple of weeks ago, I put out a paper called Happy Holidays, Fun and Profit in the Coming Bank Collapse. I read that paper to you on the air. And I shared with you my good friend David Martin's blog. He is the Inverted Alchemist. And you can find him at invertedalchemy.com. And you could read his blog. He is a financial consultant, international financial consultant, who is not only hired by companies, he's hired by governments to give them advice. We concur on this. One of the things that we warned you about is that it would start slow and then it would cascade very quickly. If you have enough warning, if you have enough prescience that you can go and very slowly, very carefully move your cash into your own hands, into your own mason jar at your house, then when the holidays come, and I'm not talking about Easter, I'm not talking about spring break, I'm talking about when the bank closes its door. Okay? Now, you might think that this is a fantasy. You might think that this is something that isn't going to happen until a long way off. Well, yesterday, Cyprus Banks. No, that's not a rock band. Cyprus is a country that's close to Greece. Okay? Cyprus Banks, in a radical departure from previous aid packages, Eurozone finance ministers want Cyprus savers, those are depositors in the bank, to forfeit a portion of their deposits in return for a 10 billion euro, that's about $13 billion, bailout for the island of Cyprus, which has been financially crippled by its exposure to neighboring Greece. Now, Cyprus was okay. But if you'll remember, just by, you know, looking back at some of the news broadcasts, you'll remember cars being turned over, stores being firebombed. Why? Well, because a lot of Greeks are on welfare. They get checks from the government. And when austerity measures were put into place, that is to say, Greece said, look, people, we could no longer let you retire at 50 or 45. You're going to have to, you know, work. You're going to have to, like, do something, earn a living. The people got so mad that they rioted. Now, it's a type and a shadow, people, a type and a shadow. Because in this country, we have a much larger population on the same kind of assistance. Over 48 million households, 48 million Americans are receiving food stamp cards. These are little debit cards. They run through the ACH, Automated Clearinghouse System. Each month, they're loaded up with money to buy food. You could take the card to the grocery and you can buy food. No, you can't take it to a restaurant. No, you can't buy cigarettes or beer. But you can buy the stuff that you eat. You can buy the finest steaks. You can buy cereal. You can buy all the prepared foods that you want. And you can eat pretty darn well. Most families I know that wouldn't spend but about $300 or $400 a month on food receive $500 to $700 in food stamps, and they eat great. I could tell you, when I was in college, I had four small kids at home, and I went back to school to finish my degree. We were picking crumbs with the sparrows, and we did receive food stamps. And I paid those food stamps back many, many times over with a smile on my face. I was happy to do it. I was happy to go to work, and I was happy to get off those food stamps. Not so in Greece. In Greece, they're a little upset about it, to say the least. If the food stamp cards were shut off in this country for 10 days and it was blamed on the Republicans, you would see the death of the Republican Party. You wouldn't see a Republican elected to public office for at least 10 years. It would be a brilliant political move, and it would be devastating. Well, the decision announced yesterday morning stunned Cypriots, those are people that live in Cyprus, and caused a run on cash points, you know, anytime tellers, most of which were depleted of cash within hours. Electronic transfers were stopped. The originally proposed levies on deposits are 9.9% for those exceeding 100,000 euros and 6.7% on anything below that. That's approximately 10% of the deposits in the bank. The Cypriot government on Sunday, that's today, discussed with lenders the possibility of changing the levy to 3% for deposits below 100,000 euros and 12.5% for above that sum. In other words, hey, come on, let's sock it to the rich, come on. Anyway, that's a source close to the consultations that explained this to Reuters, on condition of anonymity, of course. The source said the discussions had the blessing of a troika of lenders from, get ready for this, the European Commission, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank. Do those sound familiar to you? Do you know that the American dollar is being shored up by the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank, a member of the Federal Reserve? In Brussels, a spokesman for Olli Rehn, the European Commissioner in charge of economic affairs, said discussions were still underway in Cyprus. if the Cypriot leaders agree on a more progressive scale for the one-off levy, in view of making it fairer for smaller savers, and provided this would have the same financial impact, the Commission would be ready to recommend that the Eurogroup endorse such an agreement, the spokesman said. So the Eurogroup is going to endorse the Cyprus government taking 10% of its depositors' money in order to sort of create its own bank bailout. Some of it paid for by the European banks, and the rest of it paid for by, well, the depositors themselves. One bank, the Cyprus Popular Bank, could have its emergency liquidity assistance, also known as an ELA, you'll hear that a lot more in the news in the coming days, funding from the European Central Bank cut by March 21st. That's 4 days from now. A default in Cyprus could unravel investor confidence in the Eurozone. In fact, Deutsche Bank was quoted today as saying, Jesus Christ could not save the Eurozone at this time. If the Eurozone comes apart, within hours, the Federal Reserve will stop printing dollars, undoing the improvements fostered by the European Central Bank's promise last year to do whatever it takes to shore up the currency bloc. A meeting of Parliament scheduled for today was postponed for a day to give more time for consultations and broker a deal, political sources said. The levy, that's the seizure of depositors' funds, was scheduled to come into force on Tuesday after a bank holiday tomorrow. Well, this breaks a taboo, making bank depositors bear some of the costs of a bailout had been taboo in Europe, but Eurozone officials said it was the only way to salvage Cyprus's financial sector. European officials said it would not set a precedent. Well, that might be what European officials are saying, but that's not what we're saying here at X Squared Radio. This is a type and a shadow, my friends, a type and a shadow. Tomorrow is a bank holiday in Cyprus. I'm telling you, if you have a large amount of money, cash in the bank, or you have a 401k, if I were you, and I am you, I already did this. And many people have already followed this advice. They've already cashed in their 401ks, paid the 10% penalty, paid the tax as it came into their and it added to their incomes, and they paid themselves out of debt. Some of them paid their houses off. Most certainly they paid their cars off, their credit cards off, their furniture payments, the boat, motorcycle, all that stuff that you own. Pay it off. And if you got cash left over, don't leave it in the bank. Because if there's a holiday, well, you already see what's happening in Cyprus. In Spain, one of four other states getting Eurozone help and seen as a possible candidate for a sovereign rescue, officials were quick to say Cyprus was a unique case. A Bank of Spain spokesman said there had been no sign of deposit flight. And that's an absolute falsehood. Because a month ago and 2 months ago and 3 months ago, it was major headlines that millionaires, billionaires, and people that had large amounts of cash in the bank in banks in Spain were withdrawing money and exporting it out of the country as fast as they could bail it up. They're doing exactly the same thing in this country. You don't believe me? Go read the articles on Paulson. Go read the articles on Buffett, Soros, and other billionaires and millionaires. They're doing exactly the same thing I'm telling you here. But the chief of Greece's main opposition, the anti-bailout Syriza party, Alexis Tsipras, blamed the move on German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Of course Alexis would blame her, according to Greek state news. The Germans are sick and tired of bailing out the Greeks. And the Greeks are saying, oh, come on, you have. The Germans have the money and the Greeks don't, and you can afford to bail us out, and so you're going to. Well, we shall see. Ms. Merkel's, Cyprus says, we must all together raise a shield to protect the peoples of Europe from Ms. Merkel's criminal strategy. Well, he might think it's her criminal strategy, but the only currency that's strong in Europe is the mark, what was the German mark, and of course, certainly British sterling. The British mark is cut in half by becoming part of the euro. British sterling, although they do accept euros there, they never did give up the British sterling. They still use that form of money. The crisis is unprecedented in the history of the Mediterranean island, which suffered a war and ethnic split in 1974, in which a quarter of its population was internally displaced. Now, there's more to it than this. I'm going to play you this link. And I, just so you don't think it's only my opinion, these are the banking experts. Listen closely.
I would imagine that the dollar will lose its value. Yes, I mean, it already lost 95% of its value since the introduction of the Federal Reserve. But it took 100 years. This time around, they'll do it in 10 years. They have become more efficient.
They have. Yeah. Mark thinks they're going to create inflation. Now, the president of Japan suggests that these guys are Muppets. The president of Japan suggests that when it comes to the organization of economic affairs, if you allow leverage in your society to breach a certain level, we're not sure what that level is, but let's call it 200 or 230% of GDP, then what happens is monetary policy doesn't work. Fiscal policy doesn't work. So Japan is an example where we've had hideous politicians and hideous intervention. They've had helicopters. They have distributed free money to all of their citizens. They've built bridges to nowhere. And prices are falling, and they look set to fall further.
This decade, NIA believes the U.S. will experience an outbreak of hyperinflation that will cause the U.S. dollar to become worthless. Most economists believe the U.S. is more likely to experience a lost decade of deflation, similar to Japan after the bursting of their bubble economy. In Japan, even with prices deflating, many Japanese today are being forced to live in internet cafes or closets.
In Tokyo, there are hundreds of cyber cafes like this one that offer overnight deals. You can stay in your own cubicle with unlimited net access, free drinks and an easy chair to sleep on, all for about £8. And without a place to stay, for Nagasaki, this was better than sleeping on the streets.
This was home for Hidefumi Ito. The size of a closet, it had what he needed most, an internet hookup and computer to job search. Ito rented this net room for around $20 a day after he lost his art gallery director job, his expensive home, and went bankrupt. Then his wife and three children left him.
With average GDP growth of 10% in the 1960s, 5% in the 1970s, and 4% in the 1980s, Japan's GDP grew to the second largest in the world. However, during the years 1986 to 1991, a bubble formed in Japan. The Nikkei stock index nearly quadrupled in 5 years to reach a high in 1989 of 38,957. Altogether, between the years 1955 and 1990, Japan's stock prices appreciated 100 times in value and land prices increased 70 times in value. By 1993, Japan's bubble burst with both stock market and real estate prices being cut in half. Throughout the 1990s, Japan experienced deflation, high unemployment, and no economic growth, which led to the Bank of Japan deciding to lower interest rates in 2001 down to 0%. Despite 0% interest rates for many years, the Nikkei fell to a 26-year low in October of 2008 of 6,994, a shocking decline of 82% from its high 19 years earlier. A large part of Japan's savings has been wiped out, and many Japanese can no longer afford to retire.
Setsuko Katayama is part of a growing trend proving to be at least a short-term fix. At 68, she is one of more than 3,500 elderly people working at this burger chain alone. The oldest is 84. All across the country, people are giving up retirement to keep making ends meet. While that's good for the economy, many elderly people would logically rather be enjoying their golden years somewhere else.
Japan's official debt-to-GDP ratio is currently 203% compared to the U.S. debt-to-GDP ratio of 91.5%. This has led to hundreds of NIA members asking us why we believe the U.S. will experience hyperinflation while Japan has experienced decades of deflation.
Now, I just wanted to clear up one thing. Currently, Japan is 326% of GDP, and the United States is 126% of GDP. So these numbers have changed just in the short time between the time this report was given out in late 2012 and early 2013. That's because of the unprecedented deficit spending that the United States is making and the currency war that Japan started about 6 weeks ago. Let's continue.
About 95% of Japan's debt is held domestically within the country. Although Japan's savings rate has declined in recent years, down to 3% due to their aging population and their retirement age being raised to 65, Japan's savings rate averaged above 10% for many decades, and during the mid-1970s averaged above 20%. The Japanese built a large pool of savings that allowed their government to borrow from its own citizens.
Now, pay close attention to that. The Japanese people were saving between 10% and 20% of their own personal incomes in the bank. And what happened? The government borrowed the money. They borrowed the money from their own people, and they weren't able to pay it back. Let's continue.
The U.S. government, on the other hand, has borrowed $4 trillion from foreigners, including nearly $1 trillion from Japan. Foreigners currently hold about $10 trillion in U.S. dollar-denominated assets. Because of the dollar's status as the world's reserve currency, these dollars are being hoarded by foreigners and aren't chasing goods and services here in America. With the phony U.S. economic recovery beginning to lose steam, NIA believes the world will soon wake up and realize that U.S. budget deficits are poised to explode to new highs this decade due to the rising interest payments on our national debt and rising entitlement spending. With Japan's declining savings rate, the Japanese barely have enough savings left to fund their country's own budget deficits. How on earth will Japan continue to lend money to the U.S. so that we can fund ours? They can't, and they won't. The loss of our second largest creditor will be the breaking point for the U.S. economy. The U.S. debt Ponzi scheme will soon come to an end. To better understand why the U.S. is poised to have hyperinflation and won't get off so easily with a lost decade of deflation like Japan, let's imagine that all countries simultaneously experience hyperinflation and all fiat currencies worldwide become worthless overnight. Imagine that all debts worldwide are wiped out and the world starts fresh tomorrow with new currencies. Which country do you think will prosper based solely on real economic fundamentals? A country with Toyota and Honda, two automobile manufacturers that combined for a net income in fiscal year 2008 of $23.2 billion? Or a country with GM and Ford, two automobile manufacturers that combined for a net loss in fiscal year of 2008 of $45.5 billion. If it wasn't for government bailouts, GM and Ford would be out of business today. And without the U.S. having the world's reserve currency, it won't be possible for the U.S. to make any more bailouts in the future. If we start over from scratch, Japan will still have its television manufacturers like Sony, Mitsubishi, Hitachi, Panasonic, Funai, Sharp, and Toshiba. The U.S. doesn't have any television manufacturers, and Americans won't have any way of importing televisions. Japan had a huge trade surplus in fiscal year 2009 of $56.2 billion, while the U.S. had a gigantic trade deficit of $374.9 billion. Both countries import most of the oil they consume, but while Japan can afford to pay for its oil by exporting automobiles and televisions, the U.S. has only been able to afford its oil imports by exporting inflation. In just the first 5 months of 2010, the U.S. had a $7.6 billion trade deficit with Saudi Arabia, more than double its trade deficit with Saudi Arabia of $3.5 billion during the first 5 months of 2009. Saudi states now own $235.1 billion worth of U.S. treasuries, which NIA believes they could be getting ready to dump. The Saudi Arabian Monetary Agency just reported last month that their gold reserves have more than doubled to 322.9 tons, up from 143 tons of gold reported in March. Clearly, Saudi Arabia believes their U.S. dollar reserves are about to lose their purchasing power, and they're trying to hedge against it by diversifying into gold. Agriculture is the one bright spot for the U.S. economy. While Japan is the world's largest importer of food and has an agricultural self-sufficiency rate of only 50%, the lowest among developed nations, the U.S., on the other hand, produces enough agricultural products to be entirely self-sufficient. Unfortunately, if the U.S. can no longer afford to import oil, there will be a huge drop-off in U.S. agricultural production. Oil is essential to modern agricultural techniques used in the U.S. today. Oil is used for operating field machinery, manufacturing inorganic fertilizer, irrigation, crop drying, raising livestock, and pesticide production. The biggest agricultural use of oil is getting the food to our supermarkets. 81% of Americans now live in cities and suburbs, compared to the worldwide average of 49%. On average, most food in your supermarket travels 1,500 miles before getting there. Even if Americans cut their personal oil use for transportation by 75%, we still won't have any oil left from our domestic oil production to produce and ship food. The U.S. budget deficit in fiscal year 2009 as a percentage of GDP was 9.9%. However, using the same accounting principles that American businesses are forced to use, our real budget deficit in 2009 was 30.3% of GDP because we saw a $3 trillion increase in non-cash obligations for entitlement programs. This is more than 3.5 times higher than Japan's budget deficit to GDP ratio last year of 8.5%. The real U.S. debt to GDP ratio is also a lot higher than Japan, including unfunded liabilities for entitlements and our government's guarantee of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Total U.S. obligations have now reached $80.9 trillion, or 560% of GDP. Nearly triple Japan's debt-to-GDP ratio of 203%. Japan's economy hit peak consumer spending in 1990 and entered their lost decade from a position of strength with a balanced budget, high savings rate of 15%, low unemployment rate of 2%, and a net debt-to-GDP ratio of less than 20%. With the average American peaking in spending at age 46 and the last baby boomer turning 46 in 2010, the U.S. has just passed peak consumer spending and has entered this new decade from the weakest possible position, with a real budget deficit of $4.3 trillion, a savings rate of only 4%, a real unemployment rate of 22%, and a real debt-to-GDP ratio of 560%. The U.S. has entered this decade from the complete opposite position that Japan was in during the 1990s, so instead of seeing deflation, NIA believes the U.S. is guaranteed to enter into hyperinflation. If you would like to not only survive but prosper during U.S. hyperinflation, sign up immediately.
All right, there we go. So I didn't want to bombard you with the advertisement part of that, but the reporting was accurate, and that's why I wanted to let you see that, that we're not dealing with 126% debt to GDP. We're dealing with about 560% debt to GDP. We're also dealing with 22% unemployment. We've exported all of our manufacturing jobs. We've exported our electronic chip manufacturing, most of our auto component manufacturing, None of the financing that was once available in this country is now available because the government has borrowed it all. And the investors that would invest in American manufacturing and American business are packing up their cash, bailing it, and shipping it offshore. They're doing that specifically because our own government is competing with our own people for the same money. I want you to win. I don't want you to sign up for anything. I want you to very carefully follow my advice. I'm not recommending that you all run down tomorrow morning and pull all your money out of the bank. I'm just recommending that you go down to the bank tomorrow and start the process of getting your cash into your hands. Believe me, the bank isn't paying you any interest whatsoever on the money that you have in that bank. I'm not saying you're going to make money by keeping the money at your house. I'm saying you won't lose it. All right. We have about 20 minutes left, and I have to remind you, you're listening to this as an archive, because for the first time in 8 years, some force beyond our control, beyond the control of our expert and loving producers in Paradise, has pulled the entire Channel 2 off the air. That means that we are not streaming out there to you live, free. So what we will do as you're listening to this archive is, if you'll write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, I'm going to add a free month to your subscription. Free month. I know, it's only $2.50, but it's a free month because of the inconvenience of some force out there taking one of the largest radio networks in the world off the air tonight. You can be listening and should be listening to the conference line. It's at 805-399-1000. I suggest you put that number in your phone right now, 805-399-1000, and then comma, 769-608 pound. If you'll put that in your phone and save it, the next time this happens, we're knocked off the air, you can grab your phone, press the speed dial, and boom, you can be right back in, because we will never stop at BBS Radio, ever. We will always be bringing this to you. All right. All of the saber rattling that we've brought you tonight, all of the news that we've brought you tonight, is designed to prepare you. Yes, it's a little bit scary, but it's nice to know in advance, while you're working, while you're getting your tax refund check back, you are in control. You have information. You're empowered to be able to save yourself, your friends, and your family from being marched down the soup line to the fenced-in yard. Are people that don't see things the way that we do are doing things their way. Iran is, of course, moving on with their agenda. Today, they launched their own new destroyer. Yes, an ocean-going vessel designed to destroy other ocean-going vessels. They launched it domestically, which means they built everything themselves, and they launched it in the Caspian Sea. It's the nation's first heavy military presence in the oil-rich sea. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad inaugurated the guided missile destroyer Jamaran 2 in the port city of Anzali, about 250 kilometers northwest of Tehran. After final tests, the report said that Jamaran 2 will join Iran's naval fleet in the sea in coming months. The 1,400-ton destroyer, which is not that big, not that small, which has a helicopter landing pad, is, and I would love to see them try to land a helicopter on it on a typical windy Iranian day, but nevertheless, it's there. You could certainly take off from it. It's 94 meters long and can cruise at 30 knots. It is equipped with the surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles, as well as anti-aircraft batteries and sophisticated radar and communications terminals. I suggest we just steer clear of the Caspian Sea and let them, you know, put this thing around and own that part of the water. All right, change of pace. I asked the question, will life land on Mars via a comet? A pair of middle-aged tourists are not the only thing headed for Mars. Comet C-2013A1, sighting spring, is also on its way. Discovered on January 3rd of this year, some calculations of its orbit, according to Phil Plait, the rather good bad astronomer, have it passing 37,000 kilometers above the surface of the planet in October of next year, October of 2014, roughly the height at which communications satellites orbit Earth, and a remarkably close shave by cosmic standards. An official NASA website puts the most likely close approach distance between the comet and Mars as something more like 100,000 kilometers, but comets are not so predictable because they change mass all the time, you see. They come out of the Oort cloud, and as they get close to the sun, the ice and some of its liquid CO2 or solid CO2 begins to boil off. That's the tail of the comet, like we saw with the comet Pan-STARRS on the 14th when you looked up beneath the crescent moon. And when they change mass, they have a tendency to, propel themselves a little bit as these gases boil off. And they also change weight, which changes their trajectory or their orbit, if they have an orbit. And so they become a little bit like herding cats. But the minimum close approach distance, of course, is zero contact. Comets do not move smoothly on their tracks like ball bearings or planets. The gases that blow off their surfaces also act as propulsion, like, you know, little rockets, little retro rockets. And so they change direction all the time. So, though the odds are strongly against it, I mean, how strongly, no one can really say yet. I'm a statistician, and if you calculate out the probability of the trajectories, the number of possible trajectories for this comet, 2013A1, it is impossible to say it won't hit Mars because the margin of error, that is to say the plus or minus trajectory, is well within the path of Mars. And Mars has its own gravitational field, and so do its moons. So it may pull the comet into it, or the comet may come apart as it reaches what's called the Roche limit. This is where the gravity of the planet overcomes the gravity of the comet. The comet simply comes apart into several pieces, and some of the pieces hit Mars, and some of them go by. We saw Shoemaker-Levy strike Jupiter in 12 different pieces. It approached as one, but the gravity of Jupiter overcame the gravity of the head of the comet, and the comet came apart, and thus we saw multiple impacts. So even though the odds are strongly against it, the comet has a real, if not small, chance of actually hitting the planet, which would be cool in all sorts of ways. For a start, I don't think it's going to kill off anything that's on the surface of Mars, but it should be simply spectacular to see, given the unusual speed of the comet, which is moving so fast that it may as well be coming from outside the solar system. I mean, that's cool upon cool. And the fact that it's traveling the wrong way around the sun from a planet's point of view, opposite. So you got the velocity of the planet hitting the velocity of the comet, and it's going to release a lot of energy. It would be an extinction event if there was life on Mars. But the one thing that will be on Mars, well, I'll cover that in a second. Mr. Plait estimates that impact should yield a blast equivalent to that of a billion megatons of TNT. It would be an event on the same sort of scale as the impact that drove the dinosaurs extinct 65 million years ago. If it really is that big, and if the comet were to hit the side of Mars facing Earth, it seems like it might actually do that, but then it could also hit the far side. Then the blast could well be visible to the naked eye, even in daylight. Is it worth pointing out that for C-2013A1, this is the nearest thing to a direct effect on Earth that can be imagined? The recent meteor breakup over Russia and the close passive asteroid 2012 DA14 have reminded people that Earth and all other planets are vulnerable to intervention from outside. And don't forget, we have a lot of Mars rocks right here on this planet. Mars rocks that have blown off the surface of Mars, traveled across the distance of 43 million miles of space, and landed on the ice caps here on Earth. But this particular comet is not coming anywhere near Earth. But that doesn't mean it would not have scientists salivating. Observing such an impact, which might have a crater hundreds of kilometers across, would be a huge scientific observation. Of the geological processes which shape the surfaces of planets, including our own, the faces of the Moon, Mars, Mercury, and some of the topography of Earth as well. If a fair-sized comet smacks into the surface of Mars, telescopes on Earth and in orbit around it will soon be able to see a large-scale cratering in real time and remarkable detail. Telescopes orbiting Mars will do better still, but perhaps not for long. The amount of debris thrown up from the planet's surface and into space would seem likely to make their orbits quite hazardous. The cratering process would be interesting to geologists. Its aftermath would be fascinating to astrobiologists. There's also a lot of ice frozen into the Martian crust. The heat of an enormous impact would melt a huge amount of it if, as some believe, there are microbes living deep under the Martian surface. Such a burst of warm, wet conditions over a substantial chunk of the planet, in addition to the frozen life that may be in the comet itself, would give them a brief chance to thrive at and close to the surface before the planet refroze. It's not obvious how to observe such exciting developments, but there are surely already people at NASA and elsewhere giving thought to that exact matter. And they still have time. Parts of the surface and subsurface in the impact region, if there's going to be an impact, will stay warm for decades. In all likelihood, there won't be an impact. But even a near miss could be exciting, because the tail of the comet is full of methane. It's full of ice particles and maybe microbes that could land on the surface. That methane could ignite by static spark combined with some of the oxygen in that atmosphere and ignite and burn, which means it would form carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a great global warming gas. It's also a gas that is used by plants to grow. And we may get, well, something marvelous, like terraforming happening on Mars. If they pass through the comet's coma, that's exactly what could happen. Okay? The risks a close approach would pose to the spacecraft currently on the Martian surface, Opportunity, Curiosity, you know, that Spirit is already, well, my hand over my heart has already passed away. But Opportunity and good old Curiosity, which we just put up there, is running strong. They'd probably be negligible. And they, too, should get some spectacular pictures to send back to Earth. As Donald Yeomans of NASA says, unless the comet completely fizzles, it should be extraordinary as seen with Mars-based assets. And if the comet passes close enough to the planet, it may also allow a natural experiment. Over the past decade, there has been much discussion of the possibility that there might be methane on Mars, possibly produced by the aforementioned subterranean microbes. Various observers claimed to have seen evidence for the gas, but theoretical arguments cast serious doubts on their results. One of the questions in play is how fast the Martian environment can oxidize organic compounds such as methane, in other words, burn it, which get pumped or dumped into it. A very close encounter with a comet might result in a measurable pulse of organic matter being introduced into the upper atmosphere, as I said. And if there's a difference in potential, you get a massive spark. You got a spark, you got oxygen, you got organic material, and you got fire, just like the old Chicago fire. And if you have fire, you have CO2. And if you have CO2, well, you can stimulate plant life. So there you have it. That is X Squared Radio for March 17th, 2013. Exciting times that we live in. If you're a regular listener to X Squared Radio, I want you to tell a friend about us, because this year is going to be absolutely fabulous. We're going to be introducing video, and we're going to be right out there on the leading edge of new energy. Don't forget the upcoming Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference coming in October. We'll tell you much more about it in the coming weeks. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.